Santa Claus, Donald Trump, and a guy in a bathrobe stand in front of a fireplace on Christmas Eve. Santa's got a huge bag full of goodies, but the sleepy-looking guy whose house this is just points at Donald Trump and says, "I'm a political cartoonist. I already got my Christmas present." That was a holiday cartoon by the Kansas City Star's Lee Judge, and today on KCUR's Central Standard, about a week and a half into the Trump administration, we'll find out whether political cartoonists still think of this president as a gift to satire. I'm Gina Kaufman, and Lee Judge, good morning.
Good morning.
Would it be fair to say that your cartoons lean a little to the left?
It would be, yes, that would be fair and understated.
Your fellow lefties might take issue with the idea of a Trump presidency, being a gift to anyone, even political cartoonists.
Well, they're wrong. When you go in and vote, I always say I don't know whether to vote for my country or my profession. He's very good for cartoonists because he's very active. He does a lot of stuff, and some of it doesn't appear to be very well thought out, and that gives you a lot of material for cartoons.
Why does something not being well thought out give you a lot of material?
Well, when things are going right, it's more difficult to draw. I mean, cartoons and, in fact, comedy is usually a complaint about what's going on, what's happening in the world. And when someone is very, very efficient or, you know, everything they're doing is working, it's good for the country. It's not so great for cartoonists.
Well, other than the content of Trump's decisions, what is different about doing what you do under a Trump administration so far?
Well, I think the speed with which decisions are coming out, in fact, I was talking with Colleen Nelson, our new editorial page editor, and she had covered the White House, and she said, you know, usually once a day there's a meeting and, you know, some announcement is made, and now announcements and news, it's being made in the middle of the night on Twitter, you know, things are coming out at an incredibly fast rate, and sometimes so quickly it's hard to draw about everything you'd like to draw on.
We've got Glenn McCoy with us, too. And Glenn, I'm going to ask you, a similar question that I asked our other friend, Lee. Would it be fair to say that your cartoons lean a little to the right?
Yeah, I think Lee leans left, I lean right, and we kind of prop each other up. So, yeah, I come at it from the conservative side of the ideological aisle. And there's not a lot of us, so it's an exclusive club.
Of conservative political cartoonists?
Yeah, you could probably fit us in a small phone booth or the back of a smart car.
What has been your biggest challenge so far coming at the Trump presidency as a political cartoonist with a conservative, presumably a conservative audience, too?
Right. I agree with Lee in terms of how fast the news is coming at us. One of the challenges is trying to decide which topic to do, because there's easily four or five very newsworthy topics to satirize, and it becomes more of an editing process than a creative one in many days, because you just have so much to work with.
You know, I mean, I'm not telling you anything new when I say that not all conservatives agree on whether Trump is bringing positive change or something else with his administration. I mean, do you find it hard to speak to all of your readers with any one cartoon?
Sure. It's Trump is a divisive character in that before the election, I didn't think that he would come out of the gate so conservatively. I wasn't a never Trumper, but he wasn't my guy. So in terms of what I'm hearing in regards to his Supreme Court picks and his aggressive approach on another fronts, I'm kind of cautiously optimistic.
So how does caution work when you're drawing a cartoon? Is cautiousness hard to communicate?
Well, as a conservative, I'm small government, and I don't put a lot of faith in politicians, especially on a federal level. So I'm always wary of what these guys are up to. And so I think that's what I mean by caution, is that I always think that solutions, by and large, come from the private sector and not the public one. So so I want politicians who sort of get out of the way of what the free market will can accomplish. And in some respects, I see Trump as being an advocate of that kind of mentality, but then on other fronts, I don't. So it's that's where the caution is that's where the caution lies for me.
So I guess I'm hearing you say that in some ways you see him doing what you hoped he would do, and then in other ways you see him even on the same issue, see him maybe not doing that.
I'm surprised to see him doing things that because politicians make a lot of promises, and no one really expects them to keep those promises. Trump seems to be at breakneck speed trying to check off all the boxes of the promises that he's made. So, I mean, we'll see how long this goes. And I'm sure that with the blowback and the opposition coming from the left, it's going to be interesting to see how torn apart the country gets, or if he's just going to plow over, the opposition with the speed of the executive orders that he's issuing.
Glenn, what could you tell me about a cartoon you've done since the election that's gotten a really passionate response from your readers? And I mean passionate as in favorable or unfavorable, either way.
Since the election?
Yeah.
Well, I've done a lot of cartoons that have been sort of like I did one with about the inauguration, about all the Democrats who were sitting out. I think there was like 70 something congressmen and women who didn't attend. So I did a cartoon on that where I drew them as like children in a playpen labeled Congressional Safe Space, and there was a lot of blowback from that from some of my liberal readers, because but that's part and parcel of what we do. Where whenever you take a stand on any issue, you can sort of expect 50% of the people to disagree with it. But right now the climate is so toxic that a lot of the disagreement comes at you with a lot of hate attached. So,
Well, what was the nature of the blowback you received to that? Was it about the safe spaces in particular?
Yeah, it was. I think it was just more how I characterized because I had him, with binkies and throwing teddy bears at the TV while Trump was being sworn in. And there's one guy like in a fetal position curled up sucking his thumb and that kind of stuff, which, it's we're dealing with, satire and trying to and caricature, so it's always fun to see how silly and how fun you can make it. But a lot of the times these cartoons are done with a wink, but that sort of gets lost in translation because everyone is already so angry to begin with that there's a lot of triggers out there that Lee and I are pulling. And
can I jump in? I mean, you're talking about having fun with something, and that does seem like it would be, kind of challenging in a climate where a lot of people really aren't having fun.
Right. And we're, we're provocateurs. So we're trying to stir the pot to an extent and get people talking. And that's to be expected. I mean, I think cartoonists have very thick skin, probably not the day they start doing the job, but certainly later on, they develop it where, we get to say what we want. And we get to engage the readers with our opinions. So it's expected that you're going to get people who are angry, but it's just the degree of the anger that is kind of surprising right now. I can't remember the climate being this aggressively toxic. And I don't know, maybe Lee can.
I want to get Lee's response to this because Lee, you know, Glenn is in many ways defending the aim of your profession, which is to provoke, to stir the pot, to get people talking. Although right now people, I would say, I think it's fair to say people are talking anyway.
Yeah, I don't think they need much encouragement right now.
But Lee, I mean, as someone on the other side of the proverbial aisle, when you hear that argument being made about a cartoon that kind of maybe you don't agree with as much, how does that sit with you?
In terms of causing controversy, is that what you're talking about? I think cartoonists are pretty much drawn to it, and they have to be, because if you ignore what's going on, if you say, I'm only going to deal with the subjects that are safe, then you're boring and so what? And if you're drawn to the controversy that's going on in the country and you have things you want to say about it, then you're going to be mixing it up with people. You just don't have a choice.
Do liberals portrayed as children carrying binkies, does that bother you?
Not particularly, because we can be. You know, I think there are extremes on both sides, and I think, you know, we should try to avoid that. But no, you know, I think you use a lot of cartoon metaphors and things to say something. I mean, you know, I've got Obama being stabbed in the back by Republicans as, you know, it's not literal. I mean, it's a metaphor for what, you know, I think they did. But, you know, if someone wants to take it literally, they could get upset. And I think we hope, strong imagery that makes our points clear. And I think that's one of the reasons people like cartoons. And I think it's also one of the reasons people get upset by cartoons.
So I want you to describe to me one of the cartoons you've done since the election that's gotten a strong response, positive response, negative response, either one.
I think anything I do on Trump, it's a lot of times. You know, like Glenn said, you end up with thick skin. You can't survive in this business if you don't. And it used to really bother me when people disagreed. You know, it's like, hey, I want to be loved. I want everyone to think I'm terrific. And you find out, you know, it's not that way.
Let's talk about your version of Trump. He is always, in your version, he's always eyes closed, chin raised a little bit, mouth puckered, and his hair is sort of helmet, you know, Lego helmet-like, but in the Trump style,
right.
I would say. But it's interesting. He's got always a big, very triangular overcoat with little skinny stick legs coming out. I'm interested in this version of Trump.
That's just the way I draw. I think for me that I try to create, I would almost call it an icon of a character. It's not the same as if you're drawing a full face, like David Levine type caricature, because, you know, I'm going to have to use that character a quarter of an inch high, and you're going to have to know who I'm talking about. So I try to make them fairly simple and develop a feel for something that people will recognize. But that's one of the real challenges of a cartoonist, because you don't always get to draw them up close. Sometimes you've got to draw them very, very small in the scenes you come up with. So I try to come up with something fairly simple that people can recognize.
So speaking of a fairly simple one of your recent cartoons, because I'll go ahead and describe one since you were a little more general. We've got Donald Trump on one corner, and then a brick wall going kind of diagonally across the page. And then on the other side of it is the word reality. And you've written, Donald Trump has built a wall already.
Right. Yeah. That is, to me, like it was a great metaphor. You know, he'd been talking about building a wall, and then some of the stuff he was talking about I didn't think were very realistic. I think I also kind of carried on with that wall theme, and I'll probably draw it quite a few more times, him asking, you know, immigrant illegal laborers to help him build it, because that's kind of who we have build things in this country.
You know, you talked about the importance of a simple image and a simple message and something that's sort of quickly identifiable. Politics are nuanced. And just given, I mean, we've already talked about how polarized our country is right now, that lots of people are living in their own information bubbles. It feels to me, as a journalist at least, I mean, Like, one of the worst things we could do is oversimplify. And you're in this position of working in a format that requires you to make a point in just one or two images and very few words. How do you handle that conundrum?
Well, I think you're right. I think it does force you to simplify. And in some ways, that can be good because, you know, one of the things that frustrates people is politicians will take an issue, you know, handgun control or abortion or whatever it is, and talk it to death. And they have so many, maybe this, maybe that. And I think that's one of the things people like about cartoons, that they're very clear. But one of the things people should not do is take any one element of an editorial page by itself. Like Glenn said, we prop each other up. On an editorial page, we have long essays, and if that appeals to you, read those. Glenn is on the right, I'm on the left. And, you know, I always tell people it's like a cafeteria. It's, you know, you have a tray, put the things you like on your tray, you know, but you don't get to say, I don't like green beans, so don't serve green beans anymore. You know, someone else likes it. So the people who are probably angry at my cartoons probably love Glenn's and vice versa.
Glenn, what about you? I mean, do you find that the simplicity of an image is something that's useful to you? I mean, the necessary simplicity of an image is something that's useful to you, either in processing your own thoughts or communicating a point, or is it a challenge?
Well, it is a challenge, but I mean, we're dealing with typically one image. I mean, sometimes you get sequential and you'll have like three or four panels, But mostly it's
you come with the soundtrack, Glenn.
Yeah, I know. I'm trying to figure out how to turn this. Oh, there it is. we're trying to kind of like get everything down and boiled down to its bare essence, and I think Jeff McNally wrote a foreword to one of his books where he talks about how journalists and reporters have to play by the rules, and they have to source everything and all that. Whereas editorial cartoonists are given freer rein to exaggerate and to distort and to take things out of context. But when the smoke clears, a lot of times the editorial cartoonists than their journalist peers, because you know we're able to kind of cut to the chase. So, but. An issue is multidimensional. It's like a Rubik's Cube. And
yeah.
We're kind of like a lot of times focused on one part, one aspect. So,
yeah.
But they're also interpretive. So like
we're going to be right back. We'll pick right back up with that interpretation when KCUR's Central Standard returns. I'm Gina Kaufman. Back in a minute. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Glenn McCoy and Lee Judge. We're talking about political cartoons in a new political reality with a new administration. And if you want to ask Kansas City's political cartoonists your questions, you can call us up at 816-235-2888. If you read their cartoons, you can also offer a little feedback on how they're handling the Trump administration so far. 816-235-2888, or tweet us if you like. We're at KCUR CST. And Glenn, you were just talking to us about the necessary simplicity kind of an image of a political cartoon. You have to be able to just look at it and know what the cartoonist is saying. But you were also saying that there is an interpretive piece of it. Maybe there's something deceptively more complicated than what people think they're seeing.
Well, yeah. Like if you look at a painting in a gallery, you know, different viewers can get different things from that. And an editorial cartoon, it's the old adage, a picture's worth a thousand words. You can cram a lot of meaning into a really good cartoon, and people can take, you know, different things from it. But, you know, for me, ultimately, it's a starting point for a conversation, and you know, you're just trying to introduce ideas and to the debate. So that's kind of where I come from when I do a cartoon.
So could you talk to us a little bit about how you have handled you have to deal with Trump's appearance on some level as a political cartoonist.
Right.
You're going to have to draw him. What decisions have you made based on your more right-leaning perspective and that of your audience?
Well, I'm not sure if my ideological leanings play into it at this point. I mean, I love Lee's depiction of Trump. It's like you said, it's very iconic. You know exactly who it is from whatever size he's drawing. And I haven't really gotten that handle yet. And it usually takes me a while to warm up to a caricature of a president. Usually, are looking back at my work on Obama from the first year to how I was drawing him, a month ago. It's vastly different. I enjoy looking at different cartoonists and how they approach George Bush or Clinton or Bill or Obama from where they started and where they ended up at. And because you get familiar with the face, and then you start to use more of a shorthand approach to drawing, where you find the essence of what you key in on, and then that sort of becomes how you depict them. And at the end of the day, at the end of the term, the caricature may not look like the person as facially, you're not matching up the person as you would if you're drawing caricatures, at a theme park or wherever. But
right, because there's emotions and passions are running a little more high with this particular character. I want to jump over and ask Lee, we've been talking about the visual appearance of a president as kind of a shorthand and how that changes. I mean, how would you describe the groundwork you've laid, like some decisions you've already made that will be tools now for you in approaching what happens with the Trump administration from now on?
A lot will depend on what he does next. Glenn mentioned Jeff McNally, and during the Carter administration, Jeff started drawing Jimmy Carter smaller and smaller and smaller, and it was a great device because it was a way of reminding you that Jeff didn't think Jimmy Carter was up to the problems. He always came across as this kind of country bumpkin who wasn't able to deal with this. So as Trump makes decisions and as these things play out, the caricature and the way you're going to use it will change.
The lifted chin is interesting to me. That seems like a detail. It doesn't matter where he's standing or what he's looking at in your cartoon. You have this lifted chin, and it's a subtle decision, but I feel like this character would appear totally differently if you had his head held in any other position.
No kidding.
Yeah. Was that? Talk to me about that.
I think when I draw him, I get a sense of a guy who doesn't. He's not a great listener. You know, he's sure of what he thinks, even though it might change in 30 seconds. So probably, the idea that he's not really looking at anybody, he's kind of got his chin up, a little arrogant. That's probably what you're picking up on.
Let's talk to Brett. Brett's called us at 816-235-2888. He's calling from Smithville. Hi, Brett.
Hi, how you doing today?
Good. How about you?
Good. I just wanted to call and tell Mr. Judge that even though I tend to disagree with him on a few things, because I tend to be a conservative, and I'll admit, a lot of times I'm listening to NPR just to kind of poke holes in their story or whatever. I'm one of those guys a little bit. But the one thing I have always appreciated, he's a great artist. His wit and sarcasm, and just, I love his cartoons. Even when I hate his cartoons, you still are like, yeah, that's a pretty good cartoon. And, I just wanted to say, I think he does a great job. My favorite thing about him is when he'll point out hypocrisy on either side of the fence. I love that he points out the hypocrisy sometimes, and I just think he does a great job, and I just wanted to tell him to keep up the good work.
Well, Brett, is there, and I know I'm kind of putting you on the spot, remembering an example of anything that you read with a lot of regularity is hard, but can you think of a cartoon where maybe Lee was making fun of something that, you would expect to kind of, grind the gears of someone a little more conservative, but you liked it?
Oh, Lord. there, you know, he's done that to Obama several times. I can't remember the exact cartoon. You picked the guy with ADHD and short-term memory loss to try and remember something like that. But I can vividly remember there are several times when he might have pointed out something that Obama did that, you know, you're just like, wow, he is so right on that, though. You know, and it's just like, I think that's the biggest problem in the country is the inability of people on the right or left when they get facts just thrown in their face to stop and say, whoa, hold on a minute. Okay, yeah, I was wrong on that. And I love that Mr. Judge has quite often, you know, pointed that out. And I know he's left-leaning, and the right has given him plenty of material to do that with. But at the same time, he does it in a way that if you're a little open-minded, you can be like, oh, he's right.
Do you think so it sounds like the humor of the cartoon format maybe allows you to admit when there's a little bit of nuance there that maybe
absolutely
pokes a hole in your own argument.
You know, absolutely. I think when we take ourselves too seriously and, you know, we just turn these, I mean, the reality of it is a lot of these things that even like the recent protests at the airports, the people going to protest, if they never went to protest, how much would it affect their daily lives? You know, and I'm not saying there shouldn't be protests. What I'm saying is that people are making mountains out of issues that should be reasonably talked about. And you know, you think back to the good old days, quote unquote, of politics when everybody was a little more to the middle and you could get some things done and people could cooperate with each other once in a while. I think humor and, you know, calm feelings are essential to that.
Well, Brett,
these guys do a great job of doing just that, saying, hey, before you get too worked up, here's a joke about it. And that does exactly what you said it was going to do, which is, you know, oh, yeah, wow, hey, he's right, I'm wrong.
Thanks, Brett. So, you know, I want to pick up on something he said, because we've heard that political cartoons really get under people's skin. And Brett is making, in some ways, the opposite argument that, I mean, I'll admit a joke can really rub me the wrong way if I take something pretty seriously and if it feels like a big deal to me, partly because to laugh at a joke, you kind of have to agree on a certain set of givens. And if you don't agree on those, it can really, yeah, it can really boil your blood. That's how I experience that sometimes. But it sounds like for Brett, you know, something presented with humor can kind of soften him. And I'll start with you, Lee, because he's talking about your cartoons, but I want to hear both you and Glenn responding to this one.
Well, I agree with Brett. I'm able to look at cartoons, for instance, that I don't agree with at all and enjoy them. And, you know, either they're well executed or they make a point like Brett is talking about that maybe you hadn't considered. I might end up disagreeing, but I think maybe being in the business after a while, you have some appreciation of something well executed and well done, whether or not you ultimately agree with it. And as for drawing about Democrats, my main subject is hypocrisy. And there's plenty of hypocrisy on the Democratic side to draw about. So when, you know, Obama was in power, I was less critical of him because I agreed with him more. But my God, the Clintons, you know, I went to town on because there was so much I disagreed with what they were doing. But I think and being able to appreciate something you don't totally agree with is probably a good thing.
Before I move on to Glenn's response to this also, I mean, Brett's other point that people are making mountains out of molehills, essentially. I would think that for someone to be a political cartoonist, you would have to be passionate enough about politics to day in, day out, make this the focus of what you do. That seems like, do you think that people make too much of one political decision or another? Or do you think that, yeah, like if you didn't think it was a big deal, how could you do this job kind of?
I think it totally depends on the issue. I think what's going on now with immigration is a huge thing. And the repercussions from it are going to be huge. There are other issues, maybe having to do with political correctness, that I don't see as important, and I'd be less likely to draw about unless I was making fun of it. But I think it's very much a case-by-case basis.
Glenn, what are your thoughts about humor as something that either prods at kind of a sensitive point for people, or maybe does the opposite, maybe presents things in a light where people can have an open mind because, after all, it's just a joke?
Well, a lot of times I'm surprised because when I draw these cartoons, or some of the cartoons, I don't come at it from a very angry standpoint. Sometimes I do. And if I'm really angry, the first couple ideas I kind of throw away because they're done more from a reactionary standpoint than trying to really think through the issue. But I'm always surprised that the cartoons that provoke people and get them really angry are usually the ones that I wasn't that angry about. I was just trying to, you know, maybe add a little humor or something. And, you know, it's funny how people can see your work and take it to a level that you never intended to begin with. And then a lot of times when I am really angry and I think, boy, this cartoon's really going to whip up the reader response or get a lot of or go viral or something. Those are the cartoons that sort of like sneak under the radar and don't get the response that you want. So it's always been tricky for me. I don't know if Lee's dealt with this, but a lot of times I'm just taken aback by, boy, I can't believe people are getting this angry over this thing that I meant as a little joke, and vice versa. I can't believe people aren't responding as angrily as I hoped I could have provoked them to. So,
you know, it seems like your targets right now are a couple of things, at least from my perspective. One is the media, and another is kind of surprisingly, I'll let you say what's being made fun of in this one. You know, you've got one cartoon that's got both the elephant and the donkey running and saying, you know, run away. And what they're running away from is the Tea Party. I don't know what to make of that, whether that's, it seems at least nonpartisan in that you've got the donkey and the elephant running the same direction, doing the same thing.
Yeah, that's one of my very few forays into taking shots at both parties at the exact same time. And that's always fun when you can do that.
What were you trying to say there? Was that...
I think it was when the Tea Party was still just sort of getting its sea legs, and the two parties didn't really take it seriously. Then suddenly it rose up, and during the midterms there was a lot of candidates who were taken out of office because of this grassroots movement. So I think the cartoon is depicting that moment when both parties realized that they hadn't taken the Tea Party seriously enough, or they'd taken them for granted, and they were losing a lot of seats.
I want to turn to the media as a target because, you've got like a news anchor who's saying, you know, now for this evening's broadcast, basically, like, we're going to retell you everything you already read on Facebook and Twitter, which is funny. But I wonder, is the media kind of an easy target? And are you the media?
For me, it's an easy target. I think for Lee, too, in a lot of ways. But I, as a conservative, I tend to see a lot of bias in their coverage, and my cartoons, sometimes I use them as a very small way of trying to add a little balance to the coverage, you know, sort of keen on topics or aspects of a story that I feel are getting underplayed. You know, I never really feel like bias is in necessarily how a story is being covered, but how it's not being covered or what news isn't being reported. So yeah, for me, the media, I tend to depict them as looking as silly as possible. I'll usually try to put like a hairdryer on the desk or or something like that, or there's cue cards that sort of prompt the news readers to remember to blink and that kind of thing, because I like to ridicule them just as much as the politicians.
Lee, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, it's interesting to me whether political cartoonists see themselves as part of the media or apart from the media as critics.
Well, I certainly see myself as part of the media, but that doesn't mean you don't see our own faults or take shots at them, and I've done the same thing that Glenn has done. I've drawn about the media. I'm more likely to draw about Fox News, but sure, I think we're part of the media, and I think it's fair to point at some of the mistakes we make.
Lee Judge, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And Glenn McCoy, thank you too.
Oh, thanks. It was fun.
You can listen back to this conversation about political cartoonists in Kansas City later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. When we come back, a little music. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're going to talk to a Lawrence musician, Matt Pryor, whose bands in the 90s and early 2000s had a pretty big following around here. The Get Up Kids and the New Amsterdams, those bands were what you might call, or I might call, indie pop punk, and their shows were like dance parties for like wallflowers and people who don't usually dance that much. Nowadays, Matt Pryor's making solo records, and the new one might surprise his fans. It's gentle and introspective.
When the day is done, the light begins to fade. The sun that shines so bright is slowly passing into shade. And I won't be.
Hi, Matt.
Hey.
Tell me about this song.
It's sad.
Why is it so sad?
It's one of many songs on the record that are kind of about death and dying. But it's supposed to be this sort of like mantra of that, knowing that that's a part of life and to not be scared of it. But then the last line of the song says that that's kind of a lie and I'm terrified of it. So
don't you think everyone who says that is kind of trying to reassure like themselves?
Oh, totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, this record came about because my stepfather passed away, my grandmother passed away, a very close friend of our family suddenly passed away, and it was just like, ugh.
Everything always happens all at once.
Yeah, it happens all at once, and then I was like, well, I need at least one song that's like a positive spin on, that sounds weird to say a positive spin on death, but that's kind of what it's supposed to be.
What's the positive spin for you?
Hopefully that it's just part of the ride. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what it is, you know?
You know, since the Get Up Kids days, and that's, you know, that band was really big, but a lot has changed in your life. You're a family man now, or so I understand.
Mm-hmm.
What else has changed?
That was, my daughter was one of the people singing on that song.
How old is she?
She's 14, and she's a aspiring singer-songwriter, so...
Yeah, I mean, tell me how your life is different now than it was when those bands were playing, the Get Up Kids and the New Amsterdams.
I mean, when Get Up Kids started out, we were all 18 to 20, and we were willing to go anywhere and do anything, sleep on any floor, some really gross floors, just to play, just to do, you know, it was just kind of like, and the fact that, like, it became our job was sort of like an accident. We started doing it just as like a something to do over the summer, and everyone was going to go back to school, but I mean, we still do Get Up Kids from time to time. We work on some new stuff. We play shows.
Like reunion shows.
Yeah, well, yeah, at festivals and stuff right now. It's hard because everybody's got so much other stuff going on.
Well, let's hear a little bit of an old Get Up Kids song.
And oh, boy.
Just so our listeners know, I mean, if they weren't in on that whole thing, I admittedly picked a song that might not be totally representative because it's not quite as rockin' as some of the others. I picked it because I like it.
Okay.
And it was one of your big hits. This is called Overdue. Mm.
You're a few years overdue. I spent them waiting here for you. Now your charity's refused. I can't name a penance for abuse.
What do you recognize in this song, and what about it feels maybe like this is some other guy?
Wow. That was written before I was a parent, and I think it's a little bit of me kind of coming to terms with my how do I explain this without making anybody mad? kind of my own upbringing and you know, I knew I was becoming a parent. It was right before my daughter was born. And so, yeah, there's like that line there, which is like, I don't want to make the same mistakes. I learned a lot from my parents, but some of the things I learned from them was things that I didn't want to do. And that's okay, you know?
Well, yeah, none of us, we're not carbon copies.
Exactly. Well, tell me about it. I have three kids now.
What, you know, after your more well-known bands that we've talked about, I did discover that you were in a children's band called The Terrible Twos. I have to assume that parenthood has a lot to do with that decision as well.
That was actually, it's kind of funny because the two things you've brought up now both have links to this radio station. Because Overdue was like, when that came out, it was very alienating because it wasn't a punk rock song. But Cypress Avenue gave us a really great review. And it's like one of a few people who did.
Because your fans were probably more like,
well, it's,
where's
it was
the rock?
It was a 180 at the time. And we didn't spoon feed it at all. We were just like, we're going to make this folk song now. And they're like, what? And then The Terrible Twos, the only other time I've been on this radio station was to promote that on Up to Date. So I'm just like, it was weird. He's going to pick all the songs that are somehow linked to KCUR,
which
is awesome.
Is random because I just picked them kind of arbitrarily based on my own,
maybe this place has just gotten into your blood.
So, well, let's hear a little bit of the song Grumpy Bug.
Grumpy bug, go to sleep. I won't keep you waiting. Grumpy bug, close your eyes. I've got time, I've got all night. Wait by your bed till you're drifting. I'll stay next to you till you sleep.
Clearly a song about bedtime. Did writing for kids teach you anything that you carry with you now that you're writing for your peers again? Not that kids aren't peers, but you know what I mean.
It's easier. Like, writing songs about dinosaurs and bugs is, like, really, really simple to me. Writing something, you know, writing an ode to your grandmother who just passed away was a lot harder than writing a song about my son wanting to go to sleep.
Because, well, and yeah, like a dinosaur, you're not trying to make sure you fully honor the dinosaur.
Right, right. Although I did. I feel like I did fully honor.
Well, you know, in the time since, in addition to doing a kid's band, in the time since the Get Up Kids and the New Amsterdams, I heard you took a break from music during which you tried working on a farm?
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Let's see, what is this, 2012? I just kind of quit. I was just sick of it. The music industry is kind of gross, you know? It can be. It doesn't have to be.
What's gross about it?
There are elements of it that's just not very genuine. sometimes you get a lot of people, what's the polite way to put this on the radio? We'll just say blowing smoke. We don't have to say where they're blowing smoke. And you get a lot of people, not all artists, but some people who feel like they deserve things that they didn't necessarily earn. And it's just, I was at a point in my life where I was just like, I don't like this. I want to do something with my hands. I want to follow some other passion.
I mean, it sounds like it felt maybe like there was something not authentic about what was happening within the music industry and that.
You know, I say the music industry, but it's probably more just my perception of it at the time. I was just really burnt out. And we had just done like a Get Up Kids World Tour, and it was straining, and it's like, I want to be home. So some friends of mine, I went and worked on a food truck for a minute, and then, because I like to cook and I like to grow things, and then some friends of mine had a farm, so I was like, I'll come pick radishes and listen to the radio all day.
How was that for you?
Awesome. There's no money in it, but you know, like, you go from being a touring musician to a farmhand, it's kind of a pay cut.
That is a pay. Well, actually, I'm fascinated to know that that's a pay cut because, you know.
It was for me. Maybe it's not for everybody.
So, I mean, that brings up another point that since last time you were on tour, I'm guessing, you know, we've had economic change, political change, mm-hmm. in addition to the personal life changes you've experienced. I mean, do you anticipate that going on tour as a musician is going to be a whole different animal for you? Because you're about to go with your solo album.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, probably not. It's kind of like, we started touring in the 90s, at the end of the Clinton era, through the Bush years. We were on an anti-Bush tribute album at one point, and through the Obama year. It's just like, I don't know that it, other than people's, like, economic, that sometimes you can see that, where it's just like, oh, we didn't do as much in merch here as we did last time. But then there's all sorts of other extenuating circumstances too, because it's like if your fan base that used to come see you in the city has all moved to the suburbs, they don't necessarily want to come back into the city to go see you perform.
I mean, just quickly before we hear a little bit of one last song,
sure.
I'm curious if your sense of who you're performing for has changed, only because you hear so much these days of people feeling like they've learned something about this country from the election that maybe wasn't as they thought it was.
So wait, what are you asking? Like, what
if the country you're about to go tour is kind of the country you thought it was?
This is a whole bigger issue, but I think that it is. I think that there's been this perfect storm of, in my opinion, everything going wrong. but I still believe that most people are fairly, you know, are still good.
You know, we're going to not have actually time to hear another song.
That's
I'm
okay.
Sorry for teasing our listeners about that. But, you know, there's a song called A Small Explosion. And the first line is, thoughts betray us, but gears no longer grind.
Mm-hmm.
And just with, you know, part of the shift in this record being from love songs to songs about, like, life and death.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious what that line means to you.
Well, it was supposed to be about, like, getting older and, you know.
It does feel like a comment about maturity.
Maturity is a nice way to put it. I was literally thinking about, like, your body breaking down as you get older and having to, drink more water and stretch more and take ibuprofen and take better care of yourself than you did, you know.
But gears grinding doesn't sound like it's going smoothly. I mean, if gears no longer grind, I guess I was thinking about maybe, I don't know, how things get to you or.
Well, things, yeah, I could see that. Things get to me less as I get older, though. It was really more of a physical thing, I think. But, I mean, that's as good of interpretation as any.
But you make it sound like you're maybe not even, like, are you fit to go on tour?
Oh, yeah, I'm good. I'm good. The whole point of that one is to be, like, let's create, like, a small explosion just because we've become complacent. We're sitting on the porch and we're not, you know, like, initially, I don't know. My daughter's coming on tour with me on this tour, but I'd love it if my whole family, if we could just
the family band,
sell the house and buy an RV and just go on the road for a year. But one day we'll make that happen.
That sounds awesome. I'm tempted to call you Old Man Pryor based on what you just said.
You wouldn't be the first one. Grumpy Old Man Pryor, curmudgeon I've gotten a couple of times. But I'm actually really happy.
That's good. Matt Pryor, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you for having me.
You can listen back to this conversation or anything else you've heard on this show at kcur.org/centralstandard tomorrow, with talk of Russians hacking the presidential election, maybe. We're wondering what Kansas Cityans with Russian roots are feeling and experiencing in our city. Join that discussion tomorrow. KCUR Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Tudhope, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman.